1, 2, 3, 4. Greg Ashley right there, ending today's program. Changing the words to The Doors' tune, Indian Summer, from a new record called Neon Exotica. We heard The Great Unwashed, which of course is The Clean. Well, it's the Kilgour Brothers from 1983, Clean Out of Our Minds. Obscurity Blues, the track we heard. Peter Green from a 1970 solo record of his called The End of the Game with Hidden Depth. Emosphere from a new record called Cosmogonical Ears, and a track called Black Hole In, White Hole Out. Ilpo Väisänen and Dirk Dresselhaus featuring Ulrich Krieger with an excerpt from a brand new thing called Brainwave Music No. 3. Organs Obsolete, who you can see this Thursday playing at Mama Tried. That is Richard Hoffman, the bass player from Sightings. He will be performing at Mama Tried this Thursday as part of the latest Sloppy Heads monthly Heads Happening event. We heard Yes in Any Language. Dominique Rimaud did Scott Meets Leo. I don't know who Leo is. From 19 Feedbacks in the Dead Sea at the top of the set. Whoo-hoo, harsh 70s reality. The track was Suffer Bomb Damage. Oh, I gotta go. Mark Hurst is here. Tectonic is next. Have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM worldwide online, WFMU.org. Bye.
Take all the people, 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 take all Hey, everybody. Welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thank you so much for joining. It's great to have you here. We've got a great show for you today. I'm really excited about this one. Let me start by saying I have said for years on this show that the tech billionaires are dedicated to growth at any cost. And that's true. That has always been their mantra. But let's take a moment and think about growth and what. When they say growth at any cost, what are they trying to grow? And certainly they're trying to grow their companies, for example, their stock price, the worth on Wall Street if it's a public company. And that has been successful in recent years. You can look around and see the big tech companies are becoming worth more and more. Several years ago, the first, I forget which one was first to become a trillion-dollar company. It might have been Apple. The others followed suit. And I saw recently that now Microsoft has gone above the $4 trillion mark. So just an unthinkable amount of money. And then in terms of the tech billionaires themselves, you know, their personal fortunes have ballooned over several years. They now have more money than they could spend in a lifetime, in many lifetimes. And so if you think about, you know, growth, when they say growth at any cost, if you're addicted to growth and you already have so much material wealth that it's incalculable, where do you go to continue with your addiction to growth? And the answer is, apparently, looking at the behavior of the tech elite in recent years, you look to the stars. And I mean stars like outer space kind of stars. We're featuring a book on today's Tectonic that covers this strange and dangerous obsession of the tech billionaires and their army of tech bros who follow in their wake. The book is called More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. And we're going to be speaking with the author, Adam Becker. The twist here is that Adam is not a techie. He wrote a tech book, and he's not from the tech industry. He's actually an astrophysicist. But if you think about it, who better than an astrophysicist to deflate the ridiculous claims of the tech billionaires and the rest of the tech elite talking about building space stations and living on Mars, none of which is going to work, by the way. And we're going to get into all that and more, much more, with the interview with Adam Becker. If you want a link to the book and Adam Becker's website and some other materials, go to the playlist at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And just click the playlist link for the Adam Becker episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Adam Becker, author of More Everything Forever, here on Tectonic. Adam Becker, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Oh, I've been looking forward to sharing your book with my listeners because this is a great one. It's called More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. It's published by Basic Books. Here you are covering Silicon Valley and its shockingly arrogant overreach on a cosmic scale, which we're going to get into. But I wanted to start with a question about you, Adam, because you're a somewhat unexpected guide to these topics. I always write in pencil these annotations throughout the book, and here's what I wrote about halfway through. An astrophysicist who's never worked in tech has written one of the best tech books in recent memory. So tell me about your physics background and how that led you to write this book.
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad you think it's one of the best tech books in recent memory. You know, I firmly believe that anyone who's not some sort of sociopath suffers from some kind of imposter syndrome at some point in their lives. I know that I do constantly. And what you wrote as an annotation, I was constantly asking myself as a desperate question while I was writing it, which was, I've never worked in tech. I'm a scientist turned science journalist. What am I doing?
But you have a PhD in astrophysics, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Tell us just a little bit about your science background and how that ended up connecting you to big tech.
Absolutely. So, yeah, as you said, I have a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Michigan, go blue. And I finished that up in 2012. Specifically, my thesis was in early universe cosmology, trying to understand what was happening around the Big Bang and how we could get a better sense of what was happening. And by the time I finished my PhD, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to stay in academia for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the job market's, you know, not that great. And also, I have broad interests, and I had been thinking for quite some time that science journalism and science communication were areas that seemed like a good fit for me and stuff that I was interested in. And so I moved out to the Bay. For a while, I was sort of doing the things that you would sort of expect someone with that resume to do, right? You know, writing about space and physics. And my first book is sort of very much the kind of book that a physicist turned journalist would write. It's a book about quantum physics called What is Real? And then I finished that book and it did well. And I did have the opportunity to write a second book. By that point, I've been living out here in the Bay for quite some time, almost a decade, and thought, you know, I have been seeing a lot of crap coming from the tech industry and a lot of really unrealistic ideas about what the future will be like that they are peddling to us that people take very, very seriously, even though there's no scientific basis for those ideas, because there is this unspoken assumption that the leaders of the tech industry must know what they're talking about when it comes to science because they are the leaders of the tech industry. And that's just not true. The leaders of the tech industry don't really understand science particularly well, in a lot of ways, understand it worse than most people. And so that led me to this book.
And in this book, you're writing about several overlapping schools of thought that are present or even dominant in Silicon Valley. You cover effective altruism, also known as EA, effective accelerationism, which sometimes annoyingly is written as a lowercase e/acc. You cover long-termism, rationalism, one of my favorite words in the book, singularitarianism.
Yeah.
People who believe in the singularity that Ray Kurzweil and others have been predicting for a while. Together, these isms, these schools of thought, appear to be creating a kind of a new religion.
Yeah.
Centered on, let's be clear, the wealth and power of the tech billionaires.
Yeah.
Multiple times in the book, you talk explicitly about the religious aspect of this venture. And you even have a phrase for it that I like a lot. You call it the ideology of technological salvation.
As I define it in the book, the ideology of technological salvation, it's got three main components that sort of merge to form this religious or pseudo-religious set of beliefs or worldview. The first is the idea that all problems can be reduced to problems of technology in general, and computer science in particular, or computer programming. And I don't just mean, you know, problems that we would expect to be able to solve with technology, like creating a better phone messaging app, or even a problem that might be amenable to solving with better technology, like a self-driving car. I mean any problem, like world peace or immortality or what have you. The second is this idea that there will be perpetual growth, which leads to perpetual profitability. And so you can have just a perpetuation of the Silicon Valley business model forever.
And you do mean forever.
I mean forever, to the end of the universe and beyond.
And beyond.
And beyond. Yeah, Marc Andreessen, a tech venture capitalist, is very, very explicit about this. But these then point to the third thing, which is the promise of transcendence of all possible limits through the promise of technological solutions and perpetual growth. You can transcend all, you know, financial limits. You can transcend all legal limits or moral limits. You can transcend not just conventional morality, but your own biology. And you can ultimately transcend the laws of physics.
All right. So we have solutionism, that is, we can solve any problem with tech. And we have this belief in perpetual growth forever and ever. And we have this faith in transcendence, transcending all limits.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very churchy language. You know, we're talking about eternity and transcendence and faith. I want to get into an example, because here we are talking kind of on an abstract level about the religiosity of these tech billionaires and their acolytes. But I want to jump to this chapter called The Ethicist at the End of the Universe, which, by the way, I have to compliment you on your sly chapter titles, because they're all geek references of one sort or another. And you don't even reference it in the text or a footnote. I see what you're doing there, Adam Becker.
Thank you.
The Ethicist at the End of the Universe, which, of course, is a reference to Douglas Adams, but yep. I didn't need to tell my listeners that, is talking about Toby Ord and some other guys at Oxford who are interested in solving the what they see as the existential risks that we face here on Earth, primarily for them, primarily runaway AI, which has, just as a side note, Adam, I had Toby Ord on the show back in 2020 to talk about his book, The Precipice,
right,
which was all about existential risk. This is before all of the, or maybe just before I really understood the extent of long-termism and effective altruism that he's so involved in. And I remember being pretty intrigued by this book. He's talking about, will it be a meteor? Will it be a plague? Of course, this aired during COVID time. But our one point of contention was, I said, Toby, do you really think AI is going to threaten all of humanity? And he said, yes. Yeah. And so he's dead serious about this.
Yes.
So the idea with long-termism, this is the example I want to get to, is the idea that our future, this is the techies talking, that our future is in the stars. We are going to get off of this planet. We're going to colonize other star systems in the galaxy, and there's not going to be billions of humans. There will be trillions and trillions of trillions of humans in the future. And so we have to build now for that bright, shining future.
Yeah, I mean, another one of these effective altruists, like one of the main leaders, Will McCaskill, he said that there's a moral case for space settlement. And Ord, in that book that you mentioned, The Precipice, he also advocates space colonization and tries to make a comparison, or makes a comparison rather, between, you know, these putative future first space colonists and the ancient Polynesian navigators who settled all of the islands in the Pacific, which I thought was both poorly chosen and possibly offensive. But
there's some strange mathematics also at work in this so-called morality, which is that if we're going to, and here we're going to have to talk about exponents. So, if, you know, a million is 10 to the 6, a billion is 10 to the 9, a trillion is 10 to the 12. So that exponent over 10 gets bigger and bigger. So they're talking about humans in the future numbering 10 to the 50 or something.
Yeah.
And so talk me through, Adam, just a very basic explanation of how the equation works when we're looking on the order of 10 billion humans today, and they're talking about investing in a future of potentially 10 to the 50 humans. How does that change the dynamic for what they say we should do today?
So we don't just need to talk about exponents to explain that. There's another idea that we have to talk about, which is expected value. Expected value is one of these things that you see a lot if you are, say, learning how to play a game of chance like poker or craps or something like that. So let's say that we're playing a very, very simple game where I flip a coin, and if it comes up heads, I'm going to give you a dollar. But if it comes up tails, you're going to give me a dollar. So what's the expected value in that situation for you is how much you're going to earn or lose multiplied by the probability of it happening. And then you add all of those up. So you've got a 50% chance of gaining a dollar. So that's, you know, 0.5 times one, so one half. But you've also got a 50% chance of losing a dollar. So that's minus one times a half. And so you end up with one half plus negative one half, which is zero. And so the expected value of playing this game over and over and over again is zero. You know, in all likelihood, you and I will just end up with the same amount of money that we started with. But if instead we made it so that if I flip heads, you get a dollar from me, but if it comes up tails, you have to pay me 50 cents, then suddenly the game looks a lot better for you, because then the expected value of the game is 25 cents each time we play. And so that means that you should play, because on average, you're going to get a quarter from me each time we play. This works great for evaluating games of chance. The problem is that the effective altruists like to use this to evaluate the ethical implications of various situations. And so if you have this enormous number of humans that you think is going to live in the future because you think that we're going to colonize the galaxy, then you have this, you know, like this enormous number, right? You have like 10 to the 50 humans, which is what? That's like a trillion, 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 like 100 trillion, 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 trillion. Yeah, that's yes. 10 to the 50,
that's
which
right.
is crazy. But the thing is, that's so much larger than the number of humans that are alive today, that if you can do something that will, you know, make the lives of all of those humans, all of those 10 to the 50 humans in the future better, even if there's only like a 1 in a billion chance that that future is going to come to pass, this expected value calculation tells you, well, yeah, but the number that you end up with is still so huge that you should absolutely take the chance to help all of those possible future humans over all of the humans that are definitely alive right now. And this leads to really bad conclusions like that. And to me, seems like a good argument that this is a bad way of doing ethics.
So you quote this long-termist named Nick Beckstead, who yeah. wrote a memorable passage in his PhD thesis from 2013, yeah. Which has become an important document for the long-termists, you say.
Yes.
Here's what Beckstead wrote, quote, "Saving lives in poor countries may have significantly smaller ripple effects than saving and improving lives in rich countries. Why? Richer countries have substantially more innovation, and their workers are much more economically productive." And then he adds, "Saving a life in a rich country is substantially more important than saving a life in a poor country, other things being equal." And this is just part of that quantitative morality that you were just talking about,
yeah.
that as you write later in that same chapter, funding AI safety research is trillions of times more cost-effective, say the long-termists, than preventing the spread of malaria. Yeah. Saving a billion people today isn't as good as a minuscule chance of saving 10 to the 50 people who might exist someday. So,
yeah.
This is a pattern, not just in long-termism, but throughout the book, this came up again and again, that the tech billionaires and all of these guys with this ideology are ignoring the problems that we have in the world today and ignoring the people in need today in
yeah.
favor of their own schemes
yep.
that they believe they have a moral duty to fund, which, as you later write, have no chance of coming to pass anyway.
Yeah.
But it's all because of this crazy calculus.
Yeah. There is this desire to come up with a future that is mathematically provably good. And as a big fan of math and as a big fan of things that are good, that's not how either of those things work, right? Like, You know, one of the things that they need to believe in order for any of this to work out is that it's possible to quantify and compare different amounts of goodness in different, you know, in every different possible situation in the world, like at least in principle, if not in practice. And that's just not how the world works. There's lots of good reasons to think that that is in principle impossible.
Well, I think people in major religions would probably disagree with the premise that it's better to serve the rich than the poor. I mean, that just flies in the face of the most basic morals and ethics that have been around for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, that part of Beckstead's thesis is really jaw-droppingly awful.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are just about halfway through my interview with Adam Becker, who's got a book out that I like a lot. It's called More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. And I hope you're hearing in that first part of the interview, that subtitle is not exaggerating. These guys really do want to go to space and control the fate of humanity. The arrogance is off the charts. And we're going to see in the second part of the interview I'm about to play for you that the arrogance is only matched by the cluelessness. Because these schemes are not, cannot work. Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of my interview with Adam Becker here on Tectonic. And just as a reminder, you can find the links to the book and other resources at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Here it is.
There was another outcome of this calculus that you write later in this chapter. You're saying that the long-termists have drawn another conclusion here. And this has to do with what you were just talking about, quantifying the good, or in this case, quantifying people's happiness and life, as though there is a unit called the happy. You know, like, today I had 10 happies because I ate ice cream or something. And what they're saying is that at the number of humans that they're building towards, let's just use 10 to the 50, 100 trillion, 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 even if the people in the future are just barely hanging on to a will to live, I mean, they have the most miserable existence ever.
Yeah.
That means like they're getting one happy a day, which is just barely enough to continue wanting to exist.
Yeah.
That is far, the long-termists say, that is far superior than a utopia on Earth today where all 8 billion or so people have the absolute best life.
Yeah.
Food, shelter, community, and just amazing lives. So talk to me about this, where a galaxy full of incredibly miserable people is somehow considered superior to building the best possible Earth that we can have today.
I mean, this is the natural conclusion that you come to if you say that these sorts of things have to be quantified and measured, and that your approach to ethics is just purely mathematical in this way. Like, this conclusion that you were just describing is this famous thought experiment in ethics called the repugnant conclusion. This idea that, you know, an enormous number of people who are mostly miserable and just barely happy enough to keep on living is better than a genuinely fulfilled and happy world with way fewer people in it. Most philosophers believe that the repugnant conclusion has to be false, and I agree with them, because that just seems to be true, right? Like, I think that a world of soul-crushing poverty for untold trillions of people is a worse future than one where there's a smaller number of people who are all very, very happy. I also think that, you know, these ideas of cosmic expansion and galactic colonialism that are implied in all of this are just deeply abhorrent for their own reasons. But that's not how the long-termists see it. They think that we have to do this. And the bad news for them and the good news for the rest of us is not only do we not have to do it, their philosophy is bad, but we can't do it. The actual practical logistics of colonizing space are somewhere between highly, highly improbable and genuinely impossible.
Okay, so let's talk about that. And I'm glad that you brought up those two questions, because these are the two underlying questions throughout your response to these guys. Number one, can it happen? And number two, even if it could, should it happen?
Yeah.
And I think we just explored number two there.
Yeah.
And let's go to this first question. Can it happen? So Elon Musk, among others, loves to tell us how we're going to be living on Mars. He's techno king of Mars. He's going to terraform Mars by dropping nuclear bombs on the planet. And I've seen this stuff for years, and I've always felt like, I know this is complete BS, but I don't have a PhD in astrophysics to write a book to solidly disprove what he's saying. So it's so gratifying to read this book, More Everything Forever, written by an astrophysicist, where you lay it down. This is not going to happen. So talk to us just about Mars. How hard is it for humans to make a livable environment on Mars?
It's essentially impossible. It's not happening. And this is just because Mars is an absolutely terrible place. One of the things that I'm really struck by when I talk with people about this, before I, you know, get into exactly why Mars is so awful, but one of the things I'm really struck by is the number of people who, when I tell them that, they say, but, you know, I really want to go anyway, and, like, wouldn't it be cool? And you know, I think there are a lot of people who would really want to, like, move to Mars and live their lives there. And, like, I think that those people who you're talking about do exist, and that they do not understand what Mars is like. Because if you ask those people, how would you feel about moving to the middle of the Sahara or the Gobi Desert, or moving to Antarctica in the polar night, or living your entire life and raising a family at the top of Mount Everest? All of those people would say no, or almost all. And the thing is, all of those places are so much nicer and so much easier to live in than anywhere on Mars ever. And this is because Mars is radically inhospitable. The radiation levels are too high, the gravity is too low, there's no air, and the dirt is made of poison. And that's not even all of the problems.
But other than that, Adam...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Other than that, you know, Musk says that he wants to put 1 million people there by 2050, and that it needs to be a self-sufficient colony to act as a backup for humanity. And so they need to be able to survive even if the rockets from Earth stop coming. And that's in case of a disaster here on Earth, like, you know, he often mentions an asteroid strike. First of all, Mars gets hit by more asteroids than Earth does. Second, there was a huge asteroid strike here 66 million years ago. It killed off all of the dinosaurs except for the birds, right? The really famous one. That is the single worst day in the history of complex life here on Earth. That day, that asteroid hit, there was, you know, massive tidal waves all around the Earth, a crater so deep it almost punched all the way through the Earth's crust, enormous amounts of material ejected out into space. There's probably fragments of dinosaur bone on the moon now from that impact. And when all of that stuff, you know, a bunch of that material then re-entered the atmosphere, burned up and caused a pulse of heat that cooked animals at the surface, created worldwide forest fires, and then a plume of fine material in the atmosphere cut off almost all sunlight to the surface for 10 years and cut the bottom out of the food chain. And ultimately, something like 75 or 80% of all species went extinct, and 99.9% of all individual living organisms died. Really, really awful stuff. That was a better time for life on Earth. That was a better time and place to be than the surface of Mars at any point in its history. Like, if you gave me a choice between being on Earth that day the asteroid hit or being on Mars, I would choose Earth because I would probably die on Earth, but I'd definitely die on Mars. Because if you go to Mars without a spacesuit, the air pressure is so low that you will asphyxiate while the saliva boils off your tongue. And if you build a pressure dome on the surface, you would still need to bring in air from somewhere, or, you know, try to produce it there on the surface, which would involve bringing in materials that you would then consume from, you know, off the planet. And you'd still get a lot of cancer because there's all that radiation at the surface. So what you really need to do is dig tunnels underground to protect yourself from the radiation. But then you need to deal with the fact that the dirt is poisonous and everywhere. Musk wants to terraform Mars. His plans for doing that don't work. There are no plans to terraform Mars that work because Mars is just lacking the materials that it would need, like enough water and air. And even if you somehow solve every single one of those problems and you put 1 million people on Mars, that's not enough people to be self-sufficient. Because the best economic estimates for how many people you would need to run a self-sustaining, independent, high-tech society is somewhere around 500 million to a billion people. And so what that means is if Earth did get hit by an asteroid, everyone on Mars would die because the rockets would stop coming. Whereas, you know, only most of the people on Earth would die. So Earth would still be a better option. There is nothing that we could possibly do to this planet that would make it a worse option than Mars.
Yeah. I love that about, and that was another section that I highlighted in this book. If you knew right now that another asteroid was bearing down on Earth and you were offered the choice of staying here or going to Mars, staying here would be the far better bet. I mean, Earth, even on its worst day, is more hospitable and more built for human habitation and organic life than anything on Mars, even on its best day. And then, so Musk says, well, we're going to terraform it. And here's where we get to a really key point, which is picking up on a pattern that we mentioned a little bit earlier. You write that terraforming Mars is unequivocally more difficult than solving global warming on Earth.
Yeah.
So here we see Musk looking at the challenges that we're facing here on Earth. One of the primary challenges being the climate crisis, global warming, whatever you want to call it. And he says, don't worry about the challenge here on Earth. We're going to go to Mars and we're going to terraform it. Once again, you have a tech billionaire who, rather than engaging with the problems that we all need to work on, and to be honest, he has contributed to in building his fortune, rather than addressing those problems that he's complicit in, he defers all of it, shirks all of his responsibility, and comes up with a fantasy that involves space.
Yep. That's about the size of it. I mean, the problems that we face here on Earth right now are just much easier to deal with than the problems that you would have to solve if you want to try to make a real go at doing the things that Musk wants to do. And the justifications for solving the problems here on Earth are much stronger than the justifications for trying to do any of the stuff that Musk wants to do. The difference, I think, is twofold. First of all, it's what you just said, which is, you know, Musk and the other tech billionaires bear an enormous amount of the responsibility for causing and not solving these problems. But also, and I think that this is part of why the sort of ploy that Musk has engaged in of look over at Mars has worked in the public eye so well for so long. It's more fun to talk about colonizing Mars than it is to talk about solving climate change, right? Because dealing with the climate crisis, dealing with global warming, mostly involves doing very boring, unsexy stuff. We know what we need to do. We just haven't done it because there have been a lot of vested, you know, moneyed interests that have tried to prevent the rest of us from actually addressing the problem and tried to, and so far successfully, divided us and gotten a lot of people to work against their own best interests. And that's part of why it's boring and unsexy, because it's something that we're used to talking about. It's something that's become highly politicized, and it's something that's really, really scary and slow moving. Mars, on the other hand, Mars is fun, right? That sounds like fun. Space is fun. It's the final frontier. It's everything that science fiction promised us. What could be more fun than going to space? And also, again, not terribly politicized. You know, space exploration, space research has until very recently been like a bipartisan priority in the US. And the idea that, you know, let's get a fresh start and go somewhere else and that will solve all of our problems is a tempting way of running away from a big, scary, boring problem that feels intractable. And it's also, of course, something that has a long history in the American psyche, the idea of the frontier as the solution to all of our problems.
Well, it's not like we haven't had some other warnings before. You mentioned The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury and some other sci-fi authors. Actually, I love that the epigraph to the book is the Torment Nexus quote.
Thank you.
I did a whole show on the Torment Nexus a while back. Yeah. I should put a link to that on the playlist so people can go back and get the context. The basic idea being that sci-fi authors have warned us against these horrible outcomes, and the tech bros take those sci-fi texts and movies and say, guess what I'm building?
Yeah, no, I mean, Musk has explicitly said science fiction should not remain fiction forever. And like, okay, buddy, what about the dystopian science fiction?
But I wanted to bring up one source that I don't think was mentioned in the book, and that was the movie Total Recall.
Get your ass to Mars. Yeah.
Yes. And I know that's based on a book, but the movie in particular, I thought, did a good job of highlighting the risks of a monopolist controlling the oxygen supply for people on the surface. And you bring up that exact eventuality.
Yes.
That for a high-tech society to be self-sustaining and so on, it probably would end up with the oxygen supply in the hands of one person. And guess who that would be?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, is Musk going to put 1 million people on Mars by 2050? Absolutely not. I'd be very comfortable betting as much money as I could get my hands on against that, right? Could Musk put 10 people on Mars by 2050? I think the answer to that is also no, but it's like not nearly as difficult. And especially if you push it out from 2050 and say, okay, you know, let's spot them another half century by 2100. Yeah, that seems like something that you could do if you really put a lot of time and money and effort into it. And so now you have like a base of 10 or hell, let's even call it 100 people living on Mars. And let's say that, you know, it's not just a research station, that they're really like living there and trying to live out their lives. Well, there's all sorts of problems with that I talk about in the book, including like the possible problems that would introduce into human reproduction. And like Musk and human reproduction is a whole other can of worms that we cannot get into. But like.
Oh, and I should just mention that you do have a digression in the book on Epstein.
Ah, yes.
And the strange echoes of eugenics that keep coming up with these tech billionaires.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's there. It's all in there in the way that they talk about the population crisis and the way that they talk about intelligence and testing intelligence when it comes to AI. It's all right in there. But the point I was just going to make about Mars is just that, like, even if you have 100 people living there, it's going to be a company town, and it's all going to be in the hands of SpaceX. And these people, if they don't pay their SpaceX bill, they're not going to have oxygen to breathe. I don't feel like paying an oxygen bill. I like that we have air for free.
Adam, I didn't make it to the end of Total Recall. How did that work out for all those monopolists?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
One last bit. I just wanted to touch on which is this idea of transhumanism. You have a chapter called Where No One Has Gone Before, Star Trek. Yeah. This is even more explicitly religious, if possible, than the previous chapters. You're talking about Anthony Lewandowski, who notoriously wants us to worship a godhead based on artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
You're talking about this spurious idea that we're going to upload our souls somehow into this cosmic digital cloud and live forever. How do you introduce this concept to people?
The way that I tend to think about it and talk about it with people who don't already, you know about it, is very similar to the first sentence of the book, actually, where I say, you know, the dream is always the same, go to space and live forever. There is this deep desire among these people to transcend, in particular, human biology, because it's biology, it's the human body that dies. And there's this deep-seated fear of death. I think that confronting death and confronting, you know, the limits of human biology is part of like what drives the spiritual needs that like we as people have. And I'm saying this as an atheist. I am an atheist, but I think that it is like a fundamental truth about the human psyche that all or almost all people have needs that, for lack of a better word, are spiritual, that are met by some sort of spiritual experience. And that doesn't have to be religious, and it doesn't have to involve like supernatural powers. But if you deny yourself that and say that, you know, the only thing that matters in this world is technology, then, you know, you're at risk of sort of reinventing the wheel, especially if, like Lewandowski, you're ignorant of history. Because what happens to those who are ignorant of history? Well, they repeat some stuff. So in the attempt to move beyond human biology through technology, I mean, like, there's a sense in which transhumanism is totally normal stuff, right? Because you can define it as the attempt to move beyond the limits of the human condition through technology. And there's a way in which that's fine and normal, right? Like, we want to not die of smallpox, so we have a smallpox vaccine. That's a technology and a good one. Vaccines are great, full stop. No reason why I picked that particular example at this particular moment in time. Yeah. But no, vaccines are great, right? We want to know how warm it's going to be tomorrow so we can make plans. We've got weather satellites and you know, even a National Weather Service for now. That's great, right? We have prosthetic limbs. We have other things. And we have like ways that people, like, technology can also be used to like express yourself and make your body more the way that you want it to be that a tattoo or gender reaffirming surgery, right? All of those things, great. But when you start saying, no, this is the future, this is what we have to do, is we have to radically transform the entire human condition up to and including things that the best science says are unavoidable, like death. And if death is unavoidable in the human flesh, then we need to move beyond the human flesh. I mean, then you start getting into some really serious problems, not least because there's no good reason to think that we can continue to exist beyond the human flesh, right? There's the best available science says that we are our bodies, not that we haunt our bodies or that we inhabit our bodies. We are our bodies. And there is a fundamentally haunted and dualist idea at work in the notion of brain uploading, the idea that you can take your mind and upload it to a computer that the transhumanists are so fond of. This is not in the cards. The futures that the transhumanists push are very much futures driven by a deep-seated fear of death. And again, there's nothing wrong with being afraid of death. I'm afraid of death. I have no particular plans or hopes to die anytime soon. But death is not something that's going anywhere anytime soon. And almost certainly, I mean, it's not going anywhere ever. It is something that we as human bodies are stuck with. Expecting immortality is setting yourself up not only for disappointment, but for a kind of unhealthy relationship with reality that can lead you to some like truly sick behavior. And a lot of that is what you find in the communities that I write about in my book.
And this book is a good reminder of the reality that we face. And in fact, you wrote something about this near the beginning of the book that I thought was a good thesis statement for the book. And in fact, serves as a pretty good thesis for what I'm trying to do on Tectonic. Here's what you wrote. Technological salvation is being used as an excuse to steer society in a dangerous direction in the service of an impossible future. Breaking free of these visions means understanding them. For the tech elite, These are visions of transcendence, of escape, but they hold no promise of escape for the rest of us, only nightmares closing in. To wake from the dream, we must first understand its shape. And what you're doing here is you're showing us the shape of these dreams, these nightmares of the tech billionaires, and raising awareness about it, which is the first step towards building some political will to build something better. The book is More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity, by you, Adam Becker. Great job on the book, and thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. This was a lot of fun.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Adam Becker, author of the book More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. And as you learned in the interview, Adam is not a techie himself. He's an astrophysicist and a science journalist, and I think he just did a really excellent job explaining the crackpot ideas of these tech billionaires and the rest of the tech elite who subscribe to these visions of, as he says, going to space and living forever, neither of which is going to work. And I thought it would be nice if we, in addition to hearing from Adam, if we could hear from one of the tech elite themselves. And I just happened to come across an interview between New York Times' Ross Douthat and Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is one of the main tech billionaires. He's maybe not as well known as some of the others, like Mark Andreessen or Mark Zuckerberg or what have you, Jeff Bezos. But Peter Thiel is extremely powerful in Silicon Valley and beyond. At some point, we can do maybe a show just on Thiel's influence. But there was an interesting excerpt that someone posted to Blue Sky as Douthat was asking Thiel about his thoughts about one part of this ideology that Adam Becker is writing about. And I just want to play this for you so you can hear in the words of one of the tech elite how they think about some of these topics, so you can verify this is not just Adam Becker and me spinning tales or exaggerating. This is actually how things are coming to pass, or at least how the tech elite wants things to happen. Here is the excerpt.
You would prefer the human race to endure, right? You're hesitating.
Yeah, well,
I
don't know. I would.
This is a long hesitation. This is a long hesitation.
There's so many questions implicit in
this. Should the human race survive?
Yes.
Okay.
But I also would like us to radically solve these problems.
Right.
And so, you know, it's always, I don't know, you know, yeah, transhumanism is this, you know, the ideal was this radical transformation where your human natural body gets transformed into an immortal body. And there's a critique of, let's say, the trans people in a sexual context, or I don't know, a transvestite is someone who changes their clothes and cross dresses. But we want more transformation than that. It's the critique is not that it's weird and unnatural. It's, man, it's so pathetically little. And okay, we want more than cross dressing or changing your sex organs. We want you to be able to change your heart and change your mind and change your whole body. And then Orthodox Christianity, by the way, the critique Orthodox Christianity has of this is these things don't go far enough. Like that transhumanism is just changing your body, but you also need to transform your soul and you need to transform your whole self.
Okay, so that was Peter Thiel talking about the dream of transhumanism as being explicitly a spiritual or religious venture, at least as he sees it. And yes, transhumanism is covered quite a bit in Adam Becker's book. So that just gives you an example, just one little snippet of a tech billionaire talking very easily about his vision for what tech can do and in the utopian future to come to transform all of us. And I'm sure given some time, we could come up with other excerpts so you could hear from more people. But I think a good start is just to read Adam's book, More Everything Forever. The New York Times also had a piece a few days ago called The Rise of Silicon Valley's Techno-Religion. This is by Cade Metz. I have a gift link to that story on the playlist, which you can get to at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and it's talking about the rationalist community, which overlaps with the effective altruism community, and it's a pretty fascinating look at how this cultish group was established and how it's grown and how it is still in action out in the Bay Area. And that's also an overlap that Adam Becker writes quite a bit about. So this is just another confirming voice of what Adam is telling us in that in More Everything Forever, the story by Cade Metz is paralleling everything that Becker points out. So as wild as Adam's assertions might sound, I assure you that all of this sort of thinking, this ideology is true. And in that is to say that this is actually what the tech elite are thinking. and I just, the takeaway that I can't get rid of, I can't shake this thought that the ideology that the world's most rich and powerful people increasingly subscribe to says that it's better to fund the rich, in particular the tech rich, instead of helping the poor. That's their religion. And I hope you can see how dangerous this ideology is for all of us on this planet, as the rich are trying to grab yet more money and power in their bid for growth at any cost, putting everyone else at risk, especially those who are most vulnerable today. That's about all the time I have today. I will be off, excuse me, I will be off next week. The great Stu Horvath and Sarah Clemens are going to be guest hosting. I'm really looking forward to that. In the meantime, you're listening to the world's greatest radio station, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who you can't handle. And I do have some homework for you. Until next time, friends, which I guess will be in 2 weeks, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And let's go out to a tune called Robot in a Robot's World by the Flaming Embers. Have a great week, everybody. See you next time.
You tell them, Bill Bruford, and yes. Welcome to another evening, another episode, another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here with this program every Monday night at 7, following hot on the heels of Tectonic with Mark Hurst. And there is no place in the world I'd rather be right now than playing music for you for the next hour or so. We're going to start with tonight. We're going to start with a story, a very short story tonight. I was earlier today prepping for the show. I was looking for, I wanted to play something by a group called Leitmotiv, L-E-I-T-M-O-T-I-V, who are Canadian. And I was having trouble finding their stuff, and I finally found something, and it didn't sound like them. They weren't Italian. This was an Italian song, an Italian singer, and I was baffled by this because it was very different from what I remembered this group sounding like. Lo and behold, it's a different Leitmotiv, and the Italian Leitmotiv, and they are proggy, not outright soft prog. And I thought, well, what the heck? I'll play both of them because I kind of like this Italian band who I hadn't heard earlier. So I'm going to play two different groups called Leitmotiv. The first one, again, this Italian band that I just stumbled onto today, who are sort of prog pop, you might call them, perhaps. And following that, the real item, the band that I was actually looking for, and they are from Quebec, Canada. And we will hear both kind of recent. The track I'm going to play from the Italian Leitmotiv is from 2013, and then I'll follow that again with the Canadian group. This is going to be something from like 2007, 2007, 2008. So now you know, and here we are.
Se mi lasci stare qui, dove porta questo mare, e ti illumini all'idea che la sorte è un naufragare, e se credi che io stia in procinto di partire, la mia guida è una marea, non le senti le fanfare. Abbandoni il tuo gregge. Sono intermittenti le paure dell'uomo.
to be might not be at all.